You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Nikita.
Hey, Bob. How are you doing?
Couldn't be better. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Nikita Petrov, proprietor of the Psychopolitica newsletter and also a member of the Non-Zero team. And relevantly, a native of Russia. You're currently in Spain on a multi-year vacation that happens to coincide with the Ukraine war. This is relevant, as I said, because we're going to talk about the talk of the moment in foreign policy circles as we record this is about the possibility of the Ukraine war and the Iran war becoming one war, and Ukraine possibly, according to some, trying to orchestrate this, and other parties being interested in this happening. In other words, Ukraine doing it with a certain amount of encouragement. This is one theory. It started with Ukraine, I guess 2 days ago, attacking an Iranian commercial vessel in the Caspian Sea, which is a long way from Ukraine. It's almost 500 miles. So, assuming the missile was fired from Ukraine or the drone or whatever it was, has to pass over a very big landmass, either part of Russia or kind of like Georgia, Azerbaijan. I don't know. It's a long way. And So it was considered noteworthy. And, I don't think it's an open and shut case that turning this into a wider war per se is Ukraine's goal, but it is a new and important development, and we can go over the possible motivations, and I can imagine that being one of their goals. So, I don't know. Before we get into my take, what's yours?
Well, I wanted to ask, what did you mean by encouragement from third parties? That part I didn't hear.
Well, Iran said that Israel had encouraged the strike, the Ukrainian strike. And some people noted that intensely pro-Israel Trump influencer Laura Loomer visited Zelensky in Ukraine 2 days before. I mean, it's a little alarming, first of all, that a crackpot like that is visiting heads of state, but we already knew she was visiting our head of state. So I guess, like, why not? There's that. I mean, Lindsey Graham had met with Zelensky not long before he died. And of course he's an ongoing conduit. And of course, Lindsey Graham, ardently pro-Israel. I guess you saw the video of Graham cackling when the war started. Did you see that? Somebody had footage of him when the Iran war started, when Trump finally bombed Iran.
Oh, no, I don't think I saw that.
Oh, it's really revolting. He's just like, we've been working for this for years. And I mean, that really is the truth. It's like, you always say, well, this was the provocation. This is what they did, blah, blah, blah. But there's been this coalition in the U.S. literally pushing for war with Iran for years. Foundation for Defense of Democracy is a good example of a think tank whose almost entire purpose was to start a war between the U.S. and Iran. I could go on, but Lindsey Graham's been on the case for a long time. It is a truly revolting sight. You should check it out. It's like, and now we're going to name an Air Force base after the guy, apparently.
It's a good recommendation.
In Carolina. Grant, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I will let people judge themselves. But check it out. Google the video. Graham, there's that. Now, Laura Loomer, by the way, has also had a big change of heart on Ukraine, like pretty recently. That's interesting. You know, she's suddenly very pro-Ukraine, and she used to be part of the MAGA wing that was really skeptical of that particular intervention. That is the claim. Now, I should say, you can come up with motivations that both Ukraine and Israel would have for favoring a strike like this that fall short of wanting a full-scale war. I mean, Ukraine is saying that this vessel was bringing military equipment to Russia. Certainly plausible. I mean, Iran has been supplying them with drone parts technology. And that there's been this kind of swap that Russia's been supplying Iran with intelligence that helps them target like U.S. bases and stuff. And you can imagine on that score, Israel and the U.S. thinking, well, if we can cut off the quid of military stuff going from Iran to Russia, maybe the quo, as they say, would dry up as well. The intelligence that seems pretty far fetched to me. I mean, the idea that you could even significantly slow the flow of military hardware from Iran to Russia seems pretty unlikely. But anyway, the point is, there's a complicated set of conceivable motivations. There's no hard evidence that Israel encouraged this. But, you know, I would say, Laura Loomer, it's also not clear Trump wouldn't like this, you know, because Trump, he never thinks more than one move in advance. I mean, I don't think you could say, hey, let's widen the war, and he'd go, great. But you could say, you know how much you hate Iran? Well, how about if Ukraine hits an Iranian boat? And you go, cool, you know, I can see right. that. You know, he right. can think that far in advance, you know, to think, yeah, that would feel good if I read that in the news. Let's do that.
Right. So, I heard on the Russian podcast circle, I heard that as a motivation for Zelensky to show Trump personally that, hey, I'm all in. I'm on your side. All these European countries that when you asked for support, they didn't show enough support.
Right.
I am a partner in this. Whatever you need, let me show that I can do this.
Yeah, and he's kind of been signaling that for some time. I'm in the sense that he made a big show of sending anti-drone
That's
technology
right.
to the Gulf states, you know, because Ukraine, you know, we have been using to shoot down Iranian drones during this war, missiles that cost literally more than 100 times as much as the drones, okay? And Ukraine is, you know, can't afford to spend money that way. They have developed cheaper methods, and they shared those with the Gulf states. So they've been, you know, kind of saying, what can we do?
Yeah.
I mean, of course they want to, you know, curry favor with the administration of the Gulf states. And so that's been going on a long time, but this is a new thing. I mean, these weapons have been flowing to Russia forever. And this is the first time Ukraine's done this.
Yeah. So my feeling of this, I mean, the degree of worry about this turning into a wider war, a merger of these two wars, I think kind of depends on, you know, a person's general propensity to worry. Like, there are scenarios that are catastrophic. What probability you assign to them depends on, it's largely a kind of a call that you make arbitrarily. So I try to worry less. I've been worried for too long. I don't want to do that too much. So my read on this is less of a trying to combine these two wars and make it this larger conflict, and more to make a case, which Zelensky has been making, that this has been the case already. Like, these wars are not separate. There is an axis of evil, so to speak, Russia and Iran and autocratic countries and democracies and the West need to protect themselves from that. And that's kind of existential to him, like that narrative, because the difference between Russia and Ukraine are fighting a war and the West is supporting Ukraine because they're kind of good guys. That's much weaker than Ukraine is fighting the war for the West. If not for Ukraine, these Russian troops would be coming into Europe, and it's Ukrainian people who are dying in this war, and they're the one line of defense between the West and Russia. And then if you combine that, Russia and Iran, and you could add some more actors to this list. Those are the threats to the civilized democratic world, all combined together. That narrative would be very helpful if that became the default story.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, with the axis of evil thing, you're pushing on an open door. It's long been in a lot of, you know, among a lot of American elites, common to view Iran, Russia, China, and various right. other countries as part of a kind of axis. I mean, my view has been, if you impose sanctions on a bunch of different countries, they're going to collaborate more intensively than if you don't. And so to some right. extent, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, leave aside the legitimacy of the sanctions, and my own view is in the case of Iran, they're pretty much totally illegitimate. They're more arguably make sense in the case of Russia. But you're right. I mean, it's easy to get carried away with the nightmare scenario of this getting bigger. And I don't think it's super likely. And I haven't had time to try to think of historical precedents, right? So mm-hmm. like in World War II, yeah, Europe and the Pacific kind of became combined, but I think not all that synergistically or consequentially, as I understand. I mean, basically Japan was fighting their war, Germany was fighting their war. And those two things, you know, and the war in Europe was going to be a huge thing regardless. There always is a kind of a quarrel. There are different interests among allies that amount to a correlation of motivation, you know, that draw them together. That's true. And I suppose it can happen either kind of before the war, as I think mainly happened in World War I, where the alliances were already kind of formed,
mm-hmm.
or it can happen in theory like this. And I'm sure there are precedents. I mean, the so-called French and Indian War had a lot of dimensions. Anyway, I don't know my history. I should shut up. It can happen, and Trump is exactly the kind of guy who's, you know, who could let it happen to him without him realizing it. But I think part of the backdrop here is Ukraine is in more trouble than is being reported in the mainstream media. That's my take. Now, I don't know what your take is. Do you have a take on that? I mean, the reporting in the MSM is Ukraine is kind of turning the tide, all these drone attacks on Russia, and the battle lines are barely moving. I can get into why I'm skeptical of that, but do you have a view on that?
My general sense is both countries, Russia and Ukraine, are in trouble, and neither one is close to losing, and neither one is close to agreeing to the terms of the other one. So they're just going to continue fighting. There's a long way to go for one of them to like fold.
Mm-hmm.
These drone attacks really are consequential and felt. Last time we talked about the oil refineries, and that hit across the country, you know, just citizens, normal people want to put gas in their car, found that difficult and are still finding that difficult, but not paralyzing. Since then, the next in that kind of warfare, the next target is these storage facilities of this digital marketplace called Wildberries, kind of Amazon type thing. That's recent, and that's felt again. Ukraine has its justification. They say that material is related to the war. We're sold on these marketplaces as well. But I think there's also pretty high in the administration. There have been quotes saying, explaining the other part of the rationale, we want to hit the economy more broadly. And that they're doing, I mean, these storage facilities are burning. Sellers who had their stuff there now don't have the stuff. They are asking the marketplace to refund them. I think at first they said they wouldn't, then they said that they would, but it's not big numbers. So all these small, middle-sized businesses might go out of business. Just yesterday, I think, one such owner of a business with a large following on Instagram made some kind of appeal to Putin and the authorities more broadly, like, you have to intervene here because there are a lot of people who will go out of business and then none of them will pay their taxes and then the country will suffer more broadly. So it's a thing.
They're hitting like warehouses essentially as opposed to hitting data centers that coordinate the sales?
Yeah, warehouses. Yeah.
And it sounds like this is as much like eBay as like Amazon. This is a place where a lot of independent, I mean, Amazon does that too. They give independent merchants access to their platform. But in other words, it's not like the Amazon warehouses, I don't know what they have. Anyway, it's warehouses. Okay.
I don't know the structure of the thing completely, whether they produce any stuff of their own. I sort of doubt it, but mostly it's, you can set up a shop there and use their logistical infrastructure to organize the operation.
Okay.
So that's another example in a sequence of these attacks. The guy who was fired, Fyodorov, called them perpendicular warfare. We're hitting them from an angle they...
Now, he was the defense minister that Zelensky fired?
That's the defense minister that was fired, yeah. That was... the idea was there... we'll probably return to this, that Syrsky, the commander-in-chief, and Fyodorov, the defense minister, had different theories of war. One is old school, the front line is what matters, and the other one had this, let's innovate, drone warfare, asymmetrical warfare kind of approach.
That's the official story. I have a backstory that we'll get to that's relevant to the World War III thing, kind of.
Yeah, so anyway, these are notable developments. Everybody in the country feels them. I don't see that leading to an end in this war. I don't see that really pushing Putin to the negotiation table or anything of that sort. It's just an escalation. The two countries, it's the war of attrition, as they say. It's not just the front line. You're trying to grind the other state, the other nation down where you can, because if they're losing resources in one place, their overall resources are being hit. And there is political dimension to it. There is economic dimension to it. It's not just the front lines that matters. And so it's continuing, but I don't see either one of the sides like on the verge of collapse and desperately seeking to end the conflict. They're both have their vision, maybe not super precise, but certainly not matching with the other country's vision of what the end might look like. And they're going to fight until that is resolved. And this is a difficult problem that I think some people are trying to resolve, but mostly so far it's just, let's fight. Let's see what happens. It's been 4 years and the war is, we live in a time of fast-paced technological innovation. Warfare changes quickly. So let's see what another year shows kind of approach. You know, we're not waving the white flag yet. Maybe tomorrow is going to be better than yesterday.
So here's the backstory I alluded to. And this really is relevant to the question of whether Ukraine might have a motivation to try to turn this into a wider war. So Fedorov was the defense minister. Now, the name of the military commander of the whole war for Ukraine was what? Sikorsky or something?
Syrsky,
not Sikorsky. That's like a helicopter company or something. And there was tension between him and Fedorov. And you're right, Fedorov was associated with this new, like, modern drone warfare. And Shuisky's enemies painted him as being, you know, this old-fashioned guy who mm-hmm. wants to do things the old way. Now, what I heard was that it's a little more complicated than that, which is that what Shuisky was saying was, like, he's not like anti-drone or anything. What he's saying is you're putting all these resources into this yeah. high-profile, big publicity thing about hitting Russian targets, and you're neglecting the men at the front line. Mm-hmm. And they're dying, and you're not mobilizing more, which we're going to have to do, and because if you pay attention, we are losing ground, if slowly. Mm-hmm. And by the way, you know, some people say that, like, there's these two cities, I think it's Kramatorsk and something else, maybe Slovyansk, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Maybe one of those has already fallen, but I don't think so. I mean, it's Kramatorsk and something. There's these two cities in the Donbass that, if they fall, they are part of the final belt of truly fortified defense between the Russians and the Dnipro River. Okay, so if Shuisky is right, like, you are imperiling the actual front lines by putting all these resources into these high-profile attacks on Russia. Because remember, like drones you're sending into Russia, I mean, they're not the same kinds of drones maybe you want on the battle lines, but resources are finite. You could make more drones you send into Russia, or more drones that you use to defend the soldiers on the battle lines. And so I don't think it was about drones versus not. I think, except to the extent that Shuisky did want to focus on mobilizing more manpower, but I think that's a political thing probably that Zelensky is reluctant to confront. Yeah. But in any event, if the situation is indeed that, Ukraine is losing slowly, and it could be that, you know, to quote the old line from, I guess it's a Hemingway story, how'd you go broke? Uh-huh. Gradually, then suddenly. If uh-huh. it's a situation where the lines could just break, then Ukraine needs to really hurry up and get the U.S. involved in a bigger way. Okay? So, and, you know, one way might be to start hitting Iranian ships. This is sheer speculation, but I would say that this whole idea that the tide has turned, when in fact Ukraine is losing ground, if slowly, rests on the idea that these strikes they're going to do to Russia are going to fundamentally change the situation. And I want to return to you on this because you know more about the domestic politics there than I do. But the premise is, hey, we're really putting the heat on Putin. Maybe there's like some big anti-war movement that's going to rise up. Maybe there'll be a coup and Dubs will take over or something. You know, you have to hope that the strikes on Russia are going to have that big effect if you're losing ground in the war itself. And it's just, I don't see reason to believe. I mean, Russia is retaliating against these strikes by doing huge damage to Ukraine's infrastructure. And Ukraine yeah. is a smaller country with less resources. So if you just play this out, if they keep exchanging these rocket and drone attacks, Ukraine loses that war too, unless there is a change in the political landscape in Russia, or we get the U.S., we turn this into, I mean, honestly, it's either that or you turn it into World War III, right? I mean, you at least in the sense of getting the European NATO nations involved, right? Like if you're Ukraine and the premises I've laid out are correct, and basically things are worse than the American media is reporting, which I think is the case, and maybe they're actually getting dire, you would like to get the European powers in a more active way. They're already helping out with weapons and stuff, but you'd like to, I mean, let's face it, and it's not, this isn't like character assassination to say this about Zelensky. This is what leaders in wartime do. They try to figure out ways to keep from losing. And I'm just suggesting that maybe the most plausible path for him at this point is to get other nations involved on his side. And that is one way the war could expand. And go nuclear eventually, by the way.
I don't think he would object that he wants other countries to get involved.
Right, that's my point. I think he may need it more than the American media is letting on. Because he's in worse shape.
I mean, your characterization of the war jives with everything I've heard, except for the idea that the front might fall if Russia continues this slow progression. I mean, I've heard it said, but I haven't heard a super compelling case for that. And most people that I listen to don't put too much stake on that. It's Russia is advancing slowly. What that leads to, we just don't know. I think that scenario of these particular kinds of drone strikes leading to like a regime change or something in Russia, I don't see any indication of that. Except to say again that 3 months ago, this wasn't happening, or at least not to this extent. Maybe 3 months afterwards, there's more innovation. Ukraine has, they're now talking about rockets. Like right now, you're just dealing with the drones, but come fall, maybe we're going to have rockets that strike Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a linear thing that where you're just like, there are two countries, Russia has more resources, they escalate and escalate and escalate, the one country with the more resources wins. That is, if it was so simple, then I'd say you're right. But I think there are many variables and there's always a chance of some kind of a black swan. And there's just two sides are trying to innovate and figure out how their strategy should change next month and next year for them to keep the winning edge. And what that leads to, I think we'll just have to live and see, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I think in support of your skepticism about a sudden collapse and a sudden and near-term collapse, I had Leonid Rogozin on this, another native Russian who's not in Russia, and he's an analyst of kind of Russian politics. He doesn't pass himself off as a military expert, which he's not, but he did. But when I raised the question with him, the sudden collapse or the sudden, like the momentous collapse theory, he didn't really support. I forget whether it was, I think it was partly that like things are moving very slowly. It's not like these cities are going to collapse overnight. So I don't think he's expecting near-term collapse of those cities, and that may be true. But it still holds that, and it also may be that it's not as easy to get all the way to the Dnipro River, even if they do collapse, although this is by far the most fortified belt of defense between where the Russians are and the Dnipro.
Yeah.
But it would remain
fortress
the fact
cities,
that,
they call them.
What's that?
Fortress cities, they call them, or city fortresses.
But it's still true. Like if you're Zelensky, and the truth is that you see, we're slowly losing on the ground. Russia's got more men, and I'm reluctant to mobilize more fully than you've seen these videos, right, of these Russian recruiters. Ukrainian recruiter is not the word. They go around in vans and grab guys off the street who they think are evading the draft, and they put them in a van. And these guys, like their grandmothers, are like beating the guys who are putting them in. And they don't want to lower the draft age any further. It's already this complicated. So he's in a little, I just think things are not going as well as we think. And he's already getting a lot of material and intelligent support from the West. I think from Europe in particular, the material support they're providing more and more. And by the way,
they're still providing too. And the sanctions out there. I think just today there is another sanction bill signed in the U.S. Isn't that the case?
Oh,
proposed by Graham, I think.
Yeah, it's probably in memory you know, now that we've seen, if you watch this video, that he was a psychopathic monster for sure. Let's in his honor, continue to fuck up in the way that he helped get us to fuck up. That's the way I think we should always respond to these things. But I mean, sanctions aren't the most egregious of his, and again, you know, with Russia, I mean, Russia did invade Ukraine, whatever, but,
Well, I mean, what are you going to do? Like, you're either fighting or trying to pressure or trying to negotiate a deal between the two sides, which, well, tell me if you think that the Trump administration has made and is making a good faith attempt at that. I kind of feel they might, and even if they are, it's just not an easy thing to do to put these two governments together and get a deal signed. Because yeah, they were fundamentally like, the stakes are so high for both countries, and they kind of both nudged them in that direction continuously, mm-hmm. That to sign something, like Putin just recently met with the president of Kazakhstan, Takayev, and it was a notable moment because this is like an ally. And Takayev said in the tone of voice he chose is interesting. He's like, listen, people are asking me from different countries. I receive these signals and here at home, like nobody wants this war to continue. It's got to end soon. And we don't even understand really. People are asking me why it's happening, what the causes of the war are, what the nature of this conflict is. And I have a hard time answering those questions. Like there are wars I understand. Armenia, Azerbaijan, there's a whole history. At least we understand what the fight is about. Here it's difficult. So I don't know. My humble opinion, you got to wrap this up. You got to freeze the front. So that's a perspective. But I mean, and it's speculation, theory of mind of Putin is a whole genre. But I try to hear that with Putin's ears. And I think if you stop the war with no conclusion to it, like you kept talking about the root causes, the Nazification and the militarization, and it's the West that is attacking Russia via Ukraine, and mm-hmm. then you just freeze the front lines, people are going to be happy for a bit, and then the question will arise, well, what was that first? Yeah. And then what is the guarantee that this is not going to continue next month or next year? And that concern is on both sides. Why would Ukraine trust Putin, who says, let's just stop where we are and promise to not do this again? Why would Russia, if you take that worldview where it is a U.S.-led operation for years, they've been expanding NATO, they've been putting weapons into Ukraine, they turned it into quote-unquote anti-Russia. So we stop now. Is that a pause to rearm, you know, merge the militaries more closely between these countries? And then there was the first Chechen war, and then there was the second Chechen war. If we stop now without resolving these core reasons, which are seen differently by the two sides, but both have an idea of what the core reasons are, if you don't resolve them, then any peace deal seems like a ceasefire between this and the next round of a big war, which your opponent might use that pause to prepare better.
Yeah, I mean, I would be surprised if Putin cares all that much what guys like this say. Wait, what country is he head of? That's probably
Kazakhstan.
What Putin says. That's probably what Putin says. Wait, what country is he head of? Like, we're Russia, okay?
I don't think that's Kazakhstan is a player in the region.
And so their opinion, they have what kind of, what would he worry that if he alienated the leader of Kazakhstan, would.
I mean, it's not. It, also, he was very respectful in making that. It's just a, mm-hmm. it's just like a little chink in the armor. Like your few remaining allies are saying to your face, "Listen, this is too long, and we don't even understand why this is happening." But it's not like an ultimatum of any sort. It's not.
Yeah.
Putin just sat there. You could see on his face, like.
Oh, Putin was there. I missed that. This. Putin was with him at the time.
Yeah. They're like on the same stage.
Mm.
So like he wasn't happy to hear that, but that's not going to, you know, make him make a decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that it is important to appreciate that what you just laid out is actually the genuine Russian perspective, which is that, believe it or not, this is the most common story in war, is like, believe it or not, they think they're fighting a defensive war, okay? I mean, believe it or not, Iranians, Israel really thinks this was a defensive war when they attacked you. Believe it or not, Russia thinks this was a defensive war when they attacked Ukraine.
I mean, we can never know for sure, but I think Putin does believe that. And Putin is Russian whose opinion really matters on this.
And honestly, with Israel, I'm not sure what's in the mind of the leadership, because it is so politically convenient for Bibi Netanyahu to be involved in an endless series of wars. It's keeping him out of jail and in power, but at least up to a point. But I don't doubt that he succeeded at a minimum in convincing Israel. I mean, this has been the narrative forever in Israel, is that we are always existentially threatened by almost everyone in our neighborhood. And so that the ground has been prepared for that for a long time. Anyway, the main thing is, same with the U.S. and China. If you look at stuff China is doing in the, you know, in their neighborhood, you know, their island chains and bumping Philippines, but there really is an argument that they see it as a way to protect essential shipping lanes, and just a buffer zone of defense from Western encroachment. This is just the story of war almost. And I mean, I actually did an event last night in New York about my book on AI, the God Test. And I talked about this. Like, I do think if we're going to confront the AI challenge, we're going to have to do it as a cohesive global community. And we're going to have to get over this war thing. And part of that is getting better at understanding how people on the other side of the wall are viewing the world. Because this is just the oldest story ever. Things that are at least partly motivated defensively, being seen by the adversary, is entirely offensive in nature. You have to reckon with that if you're going to try to predict the behavior of Putin. It's not so you will sympathize with him or go, you know, he's right. This was defensive. That's not the point. The point is, if he sees it that way, that's going to influence how he reacts to peace overtures and everything else. And you just have to factor that in. And because the U.S. media pays almost no attention to the fact that that is their perspective, gives American readers almost no clue that actually that's the way Russia looks at this. You know, we are ill-prepared to like go into any kind of negotiation with much in the way of prospects for success. Now, if you had a more sophisticated diplomatic apparatus, it would matter less what the public felt. But Trump, this administration is just like, you know, it's obviously amateur hour. And so, you know, kind of what Trump's seeing on Fox News is the most important single thing.
Yeah, but it is telling, like I say, I it's part of the reason I bring up Takayev, the president of Kazakhstan, and him saying this, because it's like one thing if the Americans don't see the perspective that Putin laid out time and time again since the beginning of the war, but if the president of Kazakhstan, who speaks Russian very well, who's, you know, was born in the Soviet Union, he knows the region, he knows Ukrainians and Russians, and he's like, listen, I understand Armenia, Azerbaijan, like nobody's happy about that either. Hopefully they're going to reconcile, it seems like. But you guys, I don't even get it. And that's a common perspective too, mm-hmm. in Russia itself and in the post-Soviet world.
Well, I do think Putin's motivations are complicated and involve a lot of things, including legacy and this and that. And it all gets wrapped up. And I think a lot of it has to do with his feeling that he and Russia did not get the respect they deserve after the Cold War ended.
Yeah.
And that mixes in ways that even he doesn't understand. He doesn't appreciate, you know, when your status is threatened, you tend to come up with rationales to fight back without really recognizing that it's just your insecurity at play. Not that I know, not that my status has ever been threatened, but I'm talking, you know, it happens to other people. So we should probably go into overtime.
I have a couple more things to say about Russia, okay. Ukraine. I can try to do it very quickly. So one is you, in an email, asked me about how these drone attacks in deep into Russia, oil refineries, and now these storage facilities, how the public is reacting to that. Does that make people want to wrap the war up as soon as possible, or other people who want, like were more warlike because of that. And it's hard to, like, there's no hard data. I didn't trust polling before the war, but now it's just making polls in Russia during wartime is weird activity to begin with, I kind of feel like. But even if you do look at these polls, the sense that I get is everybody wants the war to end as soon as possible. Is just how mm-hmm. you get there. And the majority, when they say, I want this to end as soon as possible, think and say, negotiate and figure something out. And then there's a minority that is invested, has been invested in this war more than others that won a victory. And so they say, we need to finish this war as soon as possible. We need to be doing to Ukrainian cities what Israel did to Gaza. Hmm. You know, we have more resources and we've been restraining ourselves, but now we're being hit here deep in the territory. So let's nuke somebody. Let's do something big. So that's one thing. Though my feeling and reasoning is, none of that really matters. Like what people think, they can think what they want. Their opinion has not been asked for. So what matters is what Putin thinks and the people around him.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine. Well, we can get into this in overtime. Is there anything else you wanna say?
Another thing is on the, you know, the prospect of this leading to some kind of a regime collapse in Russia. I don't see any indication of that. I do think that Zelensky is in a more precarious place mm-hmm. just because there are public protests, there are conflicts that are visible and public between the people in the administration. He fires people, he puts them new ones. Some people go to jail, some people are arrested, and we'll see whether they will go to jail. But it's just like a more volatile situation domestically, and he needs to keep in mind more variables. And there's threat domestically as well.
And I would say that's all the more reason to worry about what he might try to do to widen the war. So in overtime, we maybe we'll talk a little more about this, maybe not. In the last issue of Non-Zero, I trotted out a theory as to how the recent OpenAI incident in which a couple of models kind of went rogue and broke out of their quote sandbox and into this company called Hugging Face suggests a way that a different path to World War III. And we'll get into that. And you wanted to talk about I'm very interested in this, the prospects in a way. Well, you tell me if this is what you had in mind, what I have in mind, the prospects of humankind becoming a true global community, which, as I said, I think is a prerequisite for surviving the AI revolution in good shape and possibly surviving it at all?
Yeah, it's more open-ended. So this is, I suggested this theme because it came up.
Okay.
Oh, just go into overtime?
Let's keep them on the edge of their seats, but what's the trailer version? Are you talking about the possibility of global identity as a
I'm curious in looking at the seeds of different types of global identities that are already you can see here and there.
Okay.
And it would be interesting to examine, to like map this out. What are the different kinds of group identities that span the globe that are emerging? What would make them stronger? What are the tensions between them, and so forth?
That actually is, I'm definitely interested in hearing that and reacting to it in the context of my own obsessions. Okay, so if you want to get access to overtime, what do they do, Nikita?
I gotta subscribe. The link to subscription is and to the overtime segment, right, on Substack is in the show notes in the description of this video. If you're watching this on YouTube, if you subscribe, you will also get 50% off to annual subscriptions of a whole bunch of other newsletters of very respectable people who whose opinions we trust.
Yeah, and I don't know that the homepage, or homepage at nonzero.org, currently. It should, if Substack's whole thing permits this, but it should feature a prominent link to a list of those newsletters, but include Peter Beinart's, Glenn Lowry's, Paul Bloom's, Mark Leon Goldberg's, Kaiser Guo's, Derek Davison's, maybe this goes all. The list is going to expand before long, and I hope I didn't leave anybody out. But if I did, apologies.
Is me on there? Is I on there?
Are you on there?
Is the proper grammar? I'm not sure actually, because I haven't been posting. Yeah,
I don't think you're on the list. I think you're on probation for not posting an episode.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
But it's possible you can be admitted if you behave yourself. So yeah, we're going into overtime. Available to paid subscribers. To Non-Zero newsletter, and yeah, there's all these bargains, and it's like whatever. So it's a cup of coffee per month we're talking about, as they say on NPR. All right, we're going in overtime.